Hello, Radioland, Podcastville, and all the ships at sea. My name is Seth Greenland, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported Los Angeles Review of Books. On this week's show, we'll be talking to the queen of the Echo Park literary set, our friend Diana Wagman, the author of a new novel, Life Number 6. We'll be discussing a new movie by the Oscar-nominated director Joshua Oppenheimer. The movie that was nominated was called The Act of Killing. His new movie is called The Look of Silence. And we'll be talking about the long-dead filmmaker D.W. Griffith, who is making news again. And here's some good news. B.J. Novak, who we had to bump last week because we ran out of time, has kindly returned to talk about his new book. He's in the green room eating a blueberry muffin and answering email, and he'll be on later. Joining me today are my usual co-conspirators, the LA Review of Books founding editor Tom Lutz. Hello, Tom.
Hey.
And critic, author, poker player, Oscar Hammerstein aficionado, Hitler hater, Lori Weiner. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Seth.
We are here with our friend Diana Wagman, the author of many novels, most recently Life Number 6, which came out a few weeks ago. Welcome, Diana.
Hi.
Wait a minute. It's not life hashtag six?
No. It's, it we had that cover. Debate, but it's a number sign.
It's a number sign.
All right, Diana, let's begin with a global question, okay? Let's dial this one right up. Your last novel had a female protagonist who was nearly raped by a giant lizard.
Yes.
Am I correct in
you
saying that?
Correct.
I read the book, so I
yes.
hope I'm
I like the giggle on that one.
The care and feeding of exotic pets. This one, another female protagonist is being menaced by both nature and cancer.
Right.
Why do you hate women?
I just keep trying to get Oprah to pay attention to my books. And she loves women in jeopardy.
She does.
What is it about tying a woman to the railroad tracks that has so attracted you?
Well, that's interesting. I'm actually not so interested in the railroad tracks. I'm interested in getting away from the railroad tracks. I'm interested in survival. And I was thinking about it on my way over here this morning that probably every one of my books is actually about survival, what we do to survive, whether it's the minutiae of life, you know, not eating a second piece of pie because you will hate yourself later for it, that kind of survival, or getting away from a 7-foot iguana or, you know, surviving being lost at sea. I'm really fascinated by that. And I read this great book, The Survivor's Club, and he talks about the reason people survive. There are qualities to people that are survivors. This guy who was lost in the woods and realized he was wearing a bright blue jacket and climbed a tree and spread out his bright blue jacket on a tree branch very high up, so a plane going overhead saw it. Whereas some people would just curl into themselves on the forest floor and die. And what is it about people who survive? It's fascinating to me.
It would be fascinating because you're a person who survived. The book tells two stories about the same person, one when she was 19 years old, the other she's a middle-aged woman. One in which the character, as I was joking around earlier, but
right.
is true, is being menaced at sea, and the other one is being menaced by cancer, both of which happened to you.
Exactly. And, you know, I've thought about writing about this when I was lost at sea many times, and my agent thought, I told her the story once briefly, and she said, oh, you should write a memoir. But number one, I am not a memoir writer, and number two, it's not a very interesting story. I was really stupid. I was lost at sea with a bunch of other stupid people. I was saved, and I didn't learn much, I don't think. So there's not
That's
much
a perfect
story
memoir,
there.
Yeah,
there's not, you know, I didn't have an epiphany. I didn't, you know, suddenly love my parents. I just, you know, I was just the same old stupid girl. But when I got cancer, many of the feelings of having cancer brought the boat back to me. I was out of control. I couldn't do anything but sort of hold on. I had to follow protocol and other people's decisions. And it was that same sort of epic journey. And I worried I would die. You know, I really thought that. as I did when I was lost at sea. So it brought all that back to me. And suddenly I thought, there's a story here of these two kinds of journeys.
Tell the story of the actual boat.
I was living in New York City with my boyfriend, who I adored, and we were at a dinner party, and we met a man who said, I need crew on a sailboat to go from Newport, Rhode Island to Bermuda, and I'm leaving in a couple weeks. And I said, oh, that's nice. I don't know how to swim. I've never been on a boat before. And my boyfriend said, I'm going. And he offered us $300 and our flight back to New York.
Wow.
And, you know, we were...
Tom would definitely
I'm in.
Yeah, we were between
even in today's dollars.
gigs, as it were. And we had gone to make our fortune as... In the book, they're dancers because it's so much better. But in real life, I was a mime. So,
yeah, I can see the dancer's decision happening.
Yeah, I thought I can't explain this. It would take pages and pages and pages. So.
I'd read that book.
So we said yes, and I wasn't going to let my boyfriend go without me. And we set sail the day the hostages were taken.
In Iran.
Uh-huh. And I was immediately nauseous, and it began to rain, and... The minute I could turn around and see that land was gone.
Statue of Liberty waving goodbye.
Yeah, I hated it. Hmm. I was so claustrophobic. There were six of us on this little tiny boat. And I thought, I can't, where's Howard Johnson's? How do I get off?
Oh my God.
You know, where do we pull over and get gas? It's like, this is ridiculous.
When did you know that this was the book you were going to write? At what stage? I mean, had you completely recovered from the cancer? How did it occur to you to link the two stories?
Oh, that's interesting. I had completely recovered. And I went away for a month retreat. And I had finished Care and Feeding and nothing was happening with it. And my agent couldn't sell it. And it was sort of in this quandary, sort of this mess. And I thought, here I am for a month. I need to start something new. And so I just started writing the boat story. And it really wasn't until I started thinking, why is this story so prevalent 35 years later? You know, why am I thinking about it so much? And I realized, oh, yeah, it's the cancer. Right. So
you were able to write about cancer without writing a cancer book, essentially.
Right. And I didn't, you know, the cancer's in there more than I even wanted it.
I remember when my mom was suffering from Alzheimer's for mm-hmm. 8 years, and people were always trying to give me books about Alzheimer's. And I was like, no, thank you. I'm living it. I really don't, you know.
Exactly.
But, Seth, you also have a character with cancer in your novel.
I have a character with cancer. And unlike Diana, I had cancer, like Diana, different kind, but 22 years ago. And 5 minutes after I got it, when I was done weeping, I was... trying to figure out how I could possibly exploit it professionally. So I would say I had the polar opposite reaction. You are listening to the LARB Radio Hour. My name is Seth Greenland, and Tom Lutz, Lori Weiner, and I are talking to Diana Wagman.
We are putting together a video of a certain person named Todd Mesereau.
Uh-huh.
Interviewed.
Have you slept with him?
I have, actually.
That would be Mr. Diana Wagman to our
yes,
to our listeners.
To our listeners. That's why you know I've slept with him.
He interviewed Robert Stone mm-hmm. some years ago. And part of the story there is that he was an important person in your life.
He was.
You were lost at sea with him.
I was lost at sea
with
Bob.
He was the man who gave them
Bob
$300.
And I. Yeah. Actually, you know, he wrote Outer Bridge Reach, which... was a sailing book, and I read again in preparation for writing this book or while I was writing this book. And he has a very funny story about his author photo for that book was in front of a sailboat, and people wrote in and said, you know, you're so privileged, you're so this, you're so that. And he had just gone down to the marina and stood in front of a sailboat. He didn't have a sailboat. Anyway.
Again, people cathecting onto other things.
So I wrote a screenplay about a novelist, and I wrote it for Todd, my husband, to direct, and we were going to sell our house and make a movie. This was the plan. And because
that sounds like a really solid
plan. Oh, yeah. Especially since we had two kids. And,
yeah.
You know,
it was
such a good idea.
And you were not an author at this point, right?
No,
you were a screenwriter.
I was a quote unquote screenwriter.
That's important for the story.
Yes, it's very important for the story. I was a screenwriter and I thought, well, okay, I can't get a deal. I can't get a meeting. I can't even get my quote unquote agent on the phone to fire him. So I'll write a screenplay and Todd will direct it and we'll be superstars. And Todd, all his life, has worked in television and done a lot of interviews. And so I wrote into this screenplay interviews with famous writers so that they would tell the stuff about writing so my character, this famous novelist, didn't have to. And we interviewed for the teaser that we were going to make to, you know, raise some money. We interviewed Tom Robbins and John Irving and Robert Stone. And I went with him to each of these interviews. And we interviewed Robert Stone in Baltimore. And all three of them were so amazing and so loved what they did, even though they're such different writers and have different sorts of success. They were really happy. And I didn't know any happy screenwriters. All the screenwriters I knew were miserable. And I thought, you know, and in preparation for each of these interviews, I read a bunch of their books and I didn't do any interviewing. Todd did that part. But I just sat there next to him, you know, sort of thinking about it. And I talked to the writers before and after. And Robert Stone talked about how much the writing took out of him.
I used to work at night. I used to work in the Amherst College Library at night. I had a little corral. The place was completely dark. And I was must have been 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I was working on Dog Soldiers, and I was working on one scene that I'd written about 8 times. I mean, it was a very fraught scene. It was a really, it was a payoff on a character, and it had a lot to do with me, although it wasn't an autobiographical character. And I really lost it. I got, I really kind of had this emotional storm, and I kind of staggered up from my desk and out into the library, out into the stacks, and I ran across a night watchman. And we just encountered each other in the dark at 2 o'clock in the morning.
And everything would look different to him. And every person he saw would be a character. And, you know, it's just he was so absorbed and so involved. I came home from those three interviews, and the last was Robert Stone, and said to Todd, I'm going to write a novel. I'm inspired. I'm really inspired. And I wrote... I was still writing screenplays, but every time the kids went to a birthday party or anything, I'd run to the computer and work on this novel. And I know I make this sound easier than it is, but 3 years later, my sister sent it to a friend and she bought it. She was from a university press and she bought it. And I think the thing I realized was, you know, this was a complete labor of love, this first novel. It was not, I wasn't thinking about selling it. I was trying to get that high that Robert Stone got. You know, I was trying to think, oh, I just want to love writing again.
A couple of years ago, the film director Joshua Oppenheimer went to Indonesia and made a documentary called The Act of Killing about the genocide that occurred in the 60s in that country, in which he got the perpetrators to reenact their crimes. It was one of the most bizarre movies I've ever seen. The Act of Killing was nominated for an Oscar. And now Joshua Oppenheimer has a new movie out, a sequel called The Look of Silence. Laura, you talked to him. What did
I did. Well, I started off by talking about how, this won't surprise you, but how writing about Hitler has changed a lot in the last 2 decades, that it used to be that you could only discuss him through the lens of his evil, that when a biographer would write about his childhood, he would describe the childhood through the lens of as if he were born evil. And there's been a kind of evolution on that line of thinking where now people are saying, let's look at him as if he's a human being. That's the only way we can learn anything from this situation, because otherwise you divide it into us and them, evil and good, and no one learns anything. Well, Josh Oppenheimer is kind of leading the discussion that's curving that way, because he interviews perpetrators. And of course, the reason he's able to interview perpetrators is because in this war, the perpetrators won. In other words, he has said, it's like going back to Nazi Germany and talking to the leaders after they won the war. So they talk about their crimes, their mass killings, not only without shame, But gleefully, because they are in the cultural language, they were patriotic acts that helped. They're the founding fathers of the country, and they helped form the country. But they do show shame in interesting subconscious ways. They giggle. They seem very disconnected to their bodies. And he also shows that there's a price that the perpetrators pay, that their loss of humanity can be read. And so the film is about that. And it's actually
Which were you talking about, the first one or the second
one? They're both about that. But the second one is much more straightforward.
Well, let me ask you something. Having watched the first one has a very powerful ending, with spoiler alert, one of the most gleeful of the reenactors, who's reenacting a crime he actually committed, and is joking and capering through the frame for 2 hours, at the end is so overcome by what he's done that he vomits. And that's the set piece that ends the movie, where you see he's doing some kind of act of expiation that Oppenheimer gets on film. Now, how is the second film different? What does he do differently in the second
film? Well, it's very different. First, in that he does none of those dramatizations at all. This is a straightforward documentary. And he takes his protagonist, had a brother who was famously killed. I mean, 500,000 to a million people were killed in 1 year. But his brother's killing was witnessed. It was very unusual, because they would take their victims in the dead of night down to the river, and nobody saw the killings. In the case of his brother, because his brother got away and was recaptured, his brother's killing had witnesses. So it was a very famous killing among all these killings. And the brother is an optometrist. And he goes to the house of the perpetrators, the local people, and he puts on the apparatus of the optometrist over their faces. And then he interviews them, giving them a free eye exam. So they're there and they're happy to talk to him, because even perpetrators love a bargain. And he asks them about the murder of his brother. And they are kind of stuck there, and they have to answer it. Oppenheimer says, and I think fairly, that this situation has never arisen in the history of film, where you got
he's also said that he will not go back to Indonesia, because he fears for his safety.
Yes. He thinks that he will not return alive if he goes back to Indonesia. And in the family that's the focus of this film, they have moved to a safe location. They didn't want to leave Indonesia, so they are still in Indonesia, but they moved them, and they're surrounded by a bunch of people who know the situation. It's almost like a cohesive.
I was talking to a film critic yesterday, and he didn't like the first film. He was in the minority. He knew he was in the minority. And he didn't like the first film because, even though that scene with the throwing up that you mentioned at the end, he thought that wasn't enough to kind of, as you said, these horrible people are scampering through the film, having a good time for the rest of the film. And he just thought he was uncomfortable with it. And this new film, he feels, gets the balance better. And it's in part because this guy whose brother was killed, we just keep looking at his face, and he's got a very expressive face, and his face is, it's not anger that he's displaying, it's a kind of sadness, existential, deep sadness that the guy puts out. And it's a very effective, he's modeling our response in a way that there was no model for our response. One of the things I love about Oppenheimer is that he is very comfortable letting the audience have no idea what's going on, right? In that first film, that's the guys in drag and the fish.
Oh, the opening is amazing.
What is that fish?
Completely Busby Berkeley.
You don't know what it is. You don't know why they're in drag. It's never explained. And in this film opens with a man getting his eyes checked, but you don't know what it is. It just looks like something out of Brazil, the Terry Gilliam movie. It just is so surrealistic. And he lets that go on for minutes and minutes and minutes. He allows his audience to be confused by the reality they're looking at.
And of course, it's a brilliant metaphor for the entire film, which he didn't really realize until he was way into filming it, that his protagonist is an optometrist, and Oppenheimer is getting us to look at this situation in a way we've never looked at it before, and to look at these perpetrators.
Yeah, and to try to see it clearly.
And the optometrist is like a bodhisattva. He has this incredible patience as he listens to these men describe how they murdered his brother. And so you watch his patience as he listens to this. He's modeling a way for the viewer to look at it, to examine genocide in a way that we really have not yet examined genocide.
The film is The Look of Silence. It's directed by Joshua Oppenheimer. It will be playing at the New Art Theater here in Los Angeles, and you should go see it. This is Seth Greenland. I'm here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour on KPFK 90.7.
There was a news item this week. A teacher in our LA Unified School District started a petition to change the name of a middle school. The middle school is named for D.W. Griffith. It's called the David Wark Griffith Middle School. Why does the teacher want this school name changed? Because The Birth of a Nation is seen as a racist film, although in its time, D.W. Griffith was seen as having invented the vocabulary of film in The Birth of a Nation and a couple of other films from around that time.
He made 500 films, right? So he's just kind of churning these films out over and over and over again. But The Birth of the Nation is the one that we know him for. We also know it, Intolerance, you mentioned, Seth, and Broken Blossoms. There are a number of films that keep coming up in the talk about his accomplishments. But it's The Birth of the Nation that really has people upset, of course, because it's a racist film.
And Tom, it venerated the Ku Klux Klan, didn't it?
It basically said that the Ku Klux Klan saved America.
So in the movie in which he invented modern cinematic grammar, these abhorrent racial messages are buried. And now the torches and the pitchforks are out, somewhat justifiably to a lot of people. Tom, what do you think about the name change? Should LAUSD change the name of the David Wark Griffith Middle School?
Speaking of name changes, you know, The Birth of a Nation was originally called The Klansman.
Well, it was from a book called The Klansman.
Yes, by one of our most famous racist authors, Thomas Dixon.
And it's interesting that in 1915, they felt the need to change the name.
Well, The Birth of a Nation is a much stronger name than The Klansman, right? I mean, that is the message of the film. The nation is really born thanks to The Klansman.
But if we want to wipe out the name of D.W. Griffith because of the racial content of Birth of a Nation, which is understandable, I do think we also have to just look at the other side of it, which is that Charlie Chaplin called Griffith the teacher of us all. Most of the major white filmmakers of the 20th century, John Ford, Alfred Hitchcock, Orson Welles, Jean Renoir, DeMille, King Vidor, Victor Fleming, they all thought of, and Stanley Kubrick as well, they all thought of Griffith as the master of the form.
It's an amazing moment in American history, right? Because the film was the very first film ever shown in the White House. It was shown to Woodrow Wilson, who then they put a new intertitle in with Woodrow Wilson saying what a great film it was, what a great, the best telling of American history to date. Wilson was a Princeton University professor of history, right? I mean, he was supposed to know what he was talking about. That gave the film an incredible pedigree, too.
So now do we take the name off the Woodrow Wilson School of International Affairs at Princeton?
Well, what's Woodrow Wilson famous for?
The League of Nations.
What is D.W. Griffith famous for?
Birth of a Nation.
I'm just saying, those kinds of arguments really don't stand up. And I think that the idea that anybody could, at this moment in time, say, you know what, let's not take the racism of his major work into account when we make a decision about whether we're going to honor this man or not, and whether we're going to have school children think, oh, it doesn't matter whether you make the most famous racist statement of your day, you can still be honored later in life. I mean, it's just crazy to me that we would even be having this conversation. Now, are there any Jefferson Davis high schools anymore? I think that he went away a while ago, but there's now some petitions to get rid of Robert E. Lee and
Well, they're taking Confederate statues down across the country.
Exactly. Now. And is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? I don't see why that's not a good thing.
But Tom, where do you draw the line? Because do you take Thomas Jefferson's name down, who a well-known slave owner, Andrew Jackson's name, a well-known slave owner and killer of Indians?
Right. What's Thomas Jefferson's most famous accomplishment?
You know, you can only use that rhetorical device once.
Oh, I just used it a second time.
He uses it every day.
If racism is a disqualifier, where do you draw the line?
No, I do think that there's an interesting argument to be made about where that line should be drawn. I do think that that's an interesting question. And there are very few people in history who live up to our sense of all of the political proprieties.
We would have to name every school that Dwight D. Eisenhower middle school.
Oh, Eisenhower has his own problems. Well, I mean, he can't do that, right? I mean, who are you going to use?
He had an affair, but Reagan? Where do you use?
I mean, you can't. I think it's an interesting problem how you manage your relationship to your historical actors in your own past. All of those kind of pulling down of statues in Eastern Europe, right after the wall came down, in Iraq, all of that kind of re-understanding your history. I mean, what do we think about the Taliban blowing up the Buddhist statues in Afghanistan, right? I mean, obviously, there's lots of ways in which the destruction of the past is ill-advised. And there's lots of ways in which the kind of inability to re-understand your past, to re-investigate your own past, is a problem as well.
The choice really is between enshrining it or preserving it in a museum-like sense. And when you've got Thomas Jefferson's name on a high school in Brooklyn, we're enshrining the name, like Griffith's name in the middle school here. Now, by taking Thomas Jefferson's name off the school to play devil's advocate, it doesn't mean that Thomas Jefferson wasn't an important president of the United States, but perhaps he no longer deserves the endorsement that suggests.
It might make sense to not have Thomas Jefferson's name on high schools. It very well might make sense.
In an environment where people of color are going to be the majority in America, what are we going to see in the future?
Well, you know, I think we're making the mistake of not recognizing that this is just another transition. This is a transitional phase as well in terms of our evaluation of D.W. Griffith. In 1975, we put him on a postage stamp. You know, in 2015, his name may be coming down from a school building. And 30 years from now, we might be able to hold the idea in our heads that he invented the basic language of cinema and that he was a racist without so much friction. Possibly.
We had this conversation a little while ago about Günter Grass, right? And about the way in which we want our artists to be good neighbors and we want our artists to have good values. It's a very different question when you're talking about whose name's going to be on a school, right? I mean, that's a particular kind of statement. It's different than having somebody on a postage stamp.
What are they going to do with the Leni Riefenstahl Middle School?
Yeah, it's exactly what when Lori and I were talking about it.
We attended the show. That middle school, and we were proud to.
Had great architecture.
Yeah.
That's our show for this week. I would like to thank Diana Wagman. Our apologies once again to BJ Novak. We ran out of time, but he said he'll come back next week. I'd like to thank our producer and moral conscience, Jerry Gorin, our crack production team, Eric Webster and Ernesto Aureliano, and of course the irreplaceable Sid Biggs, the generosity of the Goldhirsch Foundation. Find us on the web at www.lareviewofbooks.org. Download us on iTunes. Better yet, give us a rating. 5 stars is good. For Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, this is Seth Greenland. Thanks for listening.